our connection.
Great-grandfather sounded pretty snotty when he said that. I started to say something in Jason's defense, but then I closed my mouth. I had to admit to my most secret self that Niall was almost certainly right. Jason would be full of demands, and he would talk. How often are you going to be around? I said instead, striving hard to sound nonchalant. I knew I was expressing myself clumsily, but I didn't know how else to establish some framework for this new and awkward relationship.
I'll try to visit you like any other relative would, he said.
I tried hard to picture that. Niall and I eating at the Hamburger Palace, sharing a pew at church on a Sunday? I didn't think so. I feel like there's a lot you're not telling me, I said bluntly.
Then we'll have something to talk about next time,
he said, and one sea-green eye winked at me. Okay, that was unexpected. He handed me a business card, another thing I didn't anticipate. It said simply, Niall Brigant, with a telephone number centered beneath.
You can reach me at that number any time. Someone will answer.
Thanks, I said. I guess you know my phone number? He nodded. I thought he was ready to leave, but he lingered. He seemed as reluctant to part as I was. So, I began, clearing my throat. What do you do all day? I can't tell you how strange and neat it felt to be with a family member. I only had Jason, and he wasn't exactly a close brother, the kind you told everything to. I could count on him in a pinch, but hanging out together? Not gonna happen. My great-grandfather answered my question, but when I tried to recall it afterward, I couldn't come up with anything specific. I guess he did secret fairy prince stuff. He did tell me he had part ownership in a bank or two, a company that made lawn furniture, and this seemed odd to me, a company that created and tested experimental medicine. I looked at him doubtfully. Medicine for humans, I said, to be sure I understood.
Yes, for the most part, he responded. But a few of the chemists make special things for us.
For the Fae, he nodded, fine corn silk hair falling around his face as his head moved.
There is so much iron now, he said. I don't know if you realize that we are very sensitive to iron. And yet, if we wear gloves every moment, we're too conspicuous in today's world.
I looked at his right hand as it lay over mine on the white tablecloth. I extracted my fingers, stroked his skin. It felt oddly smooth. It's like an invisible glove, I said.
Exactly, he nodded. One of their formulas. But enough about me.
Just when it was getting interesting, I thought. But I could see that my great-grandfather had no real reason to trust me with all his secrets yet. Niall asked me about my job and my boss and my routine, like a real great-grandfather would. Though he clearly didn't like the idea of his great-granddaughter working, the bar part of it didn't seem to disturb him. As I've said, Niall wasn't easy to read. His thoughts were his own as far as I was concerned. But I did notice that every now and then he stopped himself from speaking. Eventually, dinner got eaten, and I glanced at my watch, astounded at how many hours had passed. I needed to go. I had to work the next day. I excused myself, thanking my great-grandfather. It still made me shiver thinking of him that way. For the meal, and very hesitantly leaning forward to kiss his cheek as he'd kissed mine. He seemed to hold his breath while I did so, and his skin felt soft and lustrous as a silky plum under my lips. Even though he could look like a human, he didn't feel like one. He stood when I left, but he remained at the table to take care of the bill, I assumed. I went outside without registering anything my eyes saw along the way. Eric was waiting for me in the parking lot. He'd had some True Blood while he was waiting, and he'd been reading in the car, which was parked under a light.
I was exhausted. I didn't realize how nerve-wracking my dinner with Niall had been until I was out of his presence. Though I'd been sitting in a comfortable chair the whole meal, I was as tired as if we'd been talking while we were running. Niall had been able to mask the fairy odor from Eric in the restaurant, but I saw from the flare of Eric's nostrils that the intoxicating scent clung to me. Eric's eyes closed in ecstasy, and he actually licked his lips. I felt like a T-bone just out of reach of a hungry dog. "Snap out of it," I said. I wasn't in the mood. With a huge effort, Eric reined himself in.
"When you smell like that," he said, "I just want to fuck you and bite you and rub myself all over you."
That was pretty comprehensive, and I won't say I didn't have a second, split evenly between lust and fear, of picturing such activity. But I had larger issues to think about.
"Hold your horses," I said. "What do you know about fairies, aside from how they taste?"
Eric looked at me with clearer eyes.
"They're lovely, male and female both. Incredibly tough and ferocious. They aren't immortal, but they live a very long time unless something happens to them. You can kill them with iron, for example. There are other ways to kill them, but it's hard work. They like to keep to themselves for the most part. They like moderate climates. I don't know what they eat or drink when they're by themselves. They sample the food of other cultures. I've even seen a fairy try blood. They have a higher opinion of themselves than they have any right to. When they give their word, they keep it."
He thought for a moment.
"They have different magics. They can't all do the same things. And they are very magical. It's their essence. They have no gods but their own race, for they've often been mistaken for gods. In fact, some of them have taken on the attributes of a deity."
I gaped at him. "What do you mean?"
"Well, I don't mean they're holy," Eric said. "I mean that the fairies who inhabit the woods identify with the woods so strongly that to hurt one is to hurt the other. So they've suffered a great drop in numbers. Obviously, we vampires are not going to be up on fairy politics and survival issues since we are so dangerous to them, simply because we find them intoxicating."
I had never thought to ask Claudine about any of this. For one thing, she didn't seem to enjoy talking about being a fairy, and when she popped up, it was usually when I was in trouble and therefore sadly self-absorbed. For another thing, I'd imagined there were maybe a small handful of fairies left in the world, but Eric was telling me there once were as many fairies as there were vampires, though the fairy race was on the wane. In sharp contrast, vampires, at least in America, were definitely on the increase. There were 3 bills wending their way through Congress dealing with vampire immigration. America had the distinction, along with Canada, Japan, Norway, Sweden, England, and Germany, of being a country that had responded to the Great Revelation with relative calm. The night of the carefully orchestrated Great Revelation, vampires all over the world had appeared on television, radio, in person, whatever the best means of communication in the area might be, to tell the human population, "Hey, we actually exist, but we're not life-threatening. The new Japanese synthetic blood satisfies our nutritional requirements." The 6 years since then had been one big learning curve. Tonight, I'd added a huge amount to my store of supernatural lore. "So the vampires have the upper hand," I said.
"We're not at war," Eric said. "We haven't been at war for centuries."
"So, in the past, the vampires and the fairies have fought each other? I mean, like, pitched battles?"
"Yes,"
Eric said.
"And if it came to that again, the first one I'd take out is Niall."
"Why?"
"He's very powerful in the fairy world. He is very magical. If he's sincere in his desire to take you under his wing, you're both very lucky and very unlucky."
Eric started the car, and we pulled out of the parking lot. I hadn't seen Niall come out of the restaurant.
Maybe he'd just poofed out of the dining room. I hoped he'd paid our bill first.
I guess I have to ask you to explain that, I said, but I had a feeling I didn't really want to know the answer.
There were thousands of fairies in the United States once,
Eric said.
Now there are only hundreds, but the ones that are left are very determined survivors, and not all of those are friends of the princes.
Oh, good. I needed another supernatural group who dislikes me, I muttered.
We drove through the night in silence, wending our way back to the interstate that would carry us east to Bon Ton. Eric seemed heavily thoughtful. I also had plenty of food for thought, more than I'd eaten at supper, that was for sure. I found that on the whole, I felt cautiously happy. It was good to have a kind of belated great-grandfather. Niall seemed genuinely anxious to establish a relationship with me. I still had a heap of questions to ask, but they could wait until we knew each other better. Eric's Corvette could go pretty damn fast, and Eric wasn't exactly sticking to the speed limit on the interstate. I wasn't awfully surprised when I saw the blinking lights coming up behind us. I was only astonished the cop car could catch up with Eric. I said, and Eric cursed in a language that probably hadn't been spoken out loud in centuries. But even the sheriff of Area 5 has to obey human laws these days, or at least he has to pretend to. Eric pulled over to the shoulder. With a vanity plate like blood, sucker, what do you expect? I asked, not so secretly enjoying the moment. I saw the dark shape of the trooper emerging from the car behind us, walking up with something in his hand. Clipboard? Flashlight? I looked harder. I reached out. A snarled mass of aggression and fear met my inner ear.
Where? There's something wrong, I said, and Eric's big hand shoved me down into the floorboard, which would have provided a little more concealment if the car had been anything other than a Corvette. Then the patrolman came up to the window and tried to shoot me.
Chapter 5. Eric had turned to fill the window and block the rest of the car from the shooter's aim, and he got it in the neck. For an awful moment, Eric slumped back in the seat, his face blank and dark blood flowing sluggishly down his white skin. I screamed as if noise would protect me, and the gun pointed at me as the gunman leaned into the car to aim past Eric.
But he'd been a fool to do that.
Eric's hand clamped on the man's wrist, and Eric began squeezing. The patrolman started doing a little shrieking of his own, flailing uselessly at Eric with his empty hand. The gun fell on top of me. I'm just lucky it didn't discharge when it fell. I don't know much about handguns, but this one was big and lethal-looking, and I scrambled to an upright position and aimed it at the shooter. He froze in place, half in and half out of the window. Eric had already broken his arm and had kept a tight grip. The fool should have been more afraid of the vampire who had a hold on him than the waitress who hardly knew how to fire the gun, but the gun commanded his attention. I was sure I would have heard if the highway patrol had decided to start shooting speeders instead of ticketing them.
"Who are you?"
I said, and no one could blame me if my voice wasn't too steady.
"Who sent you?"
"They told me to,"
the wearer gasped. Now that I had time to notice details, I could see he wasn't wearing a proper highway patrol uniform. It was the right color, and the hat was right, but the pants weren't uniform pants.
"They who?"
I asked. Eric's fangs clamped into the wearer's shoulder. Despite his wound, Eric was pulling the faux patrolman into the car, inch by inch. It seemed only fair that Eric got some blood, since he'd lost so much of his own. The assassin began crying.
"Don't let him turn me into one of them,"
he appealed to me.
"You should be so lucky," I said, not because I actually thought it was so darn great to be a vampire, but because I was sure Eric had something much worse in mind.
I got out of the car because there was no point in trying to get Eric to release the wearer. He wouldn't listen to me with the bloodlust on him so strong.
My bond to Eric was the crucial factor in this decision. I was happy that he was enjoying himself, getting the blood he needed. I was furious that someone had tried to hurt him. Since both of these feelings would not normally be colors in my emotional palette, I knew what was to blame. Plus, the inside of the Corvette had gotten unpleasantly crowded, what with me, Eric, and most of the wear. Miraculously, no cars passed while I trotted along the shoulder to our attacker's vehicle, which, not so much to my surprise, turned out to be a plain white car with an illegal flashing attachment. I turned out the car's lights and, by punching or disconnecting every wire and button I could find, managed to kill the flashers, too. Now we were not nearly so conspicuous. Eric had shut down the Corvette's lights moments into the encounter. I looked over the inside of the white car quickly, but didn't see an envelope marked "Revelation of Who Hired Me in Case I Get Caught." I needed a clue. There should at least have been a phone number on a scrap of paper, a phone number I could look up in a reverse directory, if I knew how to do such a thing. Rats. I trudged back to Eric's car, noticing in the lights of a passing semi that there weren't any legs sticking out of the driver's window anymore, which rendered the Corvette a lot less conspicuous. But we needed to get out of there. I peered into the Corvette and found it empty. The only reminder of what had just happened was a smear of blood on Eric's seat, and I pulled a tissue out of my purse, spat on it, and rubbed the drying blood off. Not a very elegant solution, but practical. Suddenly, Eric was beside me, and I had to stifle a shriek. He was still excited by the unexpected attack, and he pinned me against the side of the car, holding my head at the correct angle for a kiss. I felt a lurch of desire, and came very close to saying, "What the hell? Take me now, you big Viking." It was not only the blood bond inclining me to accept his tacit offer, but my memory of how wonderful Eric was in bed. But I thought of Quinn, and detached myself from Eric's mouth with a great effort. For a second, I didn't think he was going to let go, but he did. "Let me see," I said in an unsteady voice, and pulled his shirt collar aside to look at the bullet wound. Eric had almost finished healing, but of course his shirt was still wet with blood.
"What was that about?" he asked. "Was that an enemy of yours?"
"I have no idea."
"He shot at you,"
Eric said, as if I was just a wee bit slow.
"He wanted you first."
"But what if he did that to hurt you? What if he would have blamed my death on you?" I was so tired of being the object of plots that I suspected I was trying to will Eric into being the target. Another idea struck me, and I veered into it. "And how'd they find us?"
"Someone who knew we'd be driving back to Bon Ton tonight," Eric said. "Someone who knew what car I was in."
"It couldn't have been Niall," I said, and then rethought my flash of loyalty to my brand new, self-proclaimed great-grandfather. After all, he might have been lying the whole time we were at the table. How would I know? I couldn't get in his head. The ignorance of my position felt strange to me. But I didn't believe Niall had been lying.
"I don't think it was the ferry either," Eric said. "But we'd better talk about it on the road. This isn't a good place for us to linger."
He was right about that. I didn't know where he'd put the body, and I realized that I didn't really care. A year ago, it would have torn me up, leaving a body behind as we sped away along the interstate. Now I was just glad it was him and not me who was lying in the woods. I was a terrible Christian and a decent survivalist. As we drove through the dark, I pondered the chasm yawning right in front of me, waiting for me to take that extra step. I felt stranded on that brink. I found it harder and harder to stick to what was right when what was expedient made better sense. Really, my brain told me ruthlessly, didn't I understand that Quinn had dumped me? Wouldn't he have gotten in touch if he still considered us a couple? Hadn't I always had a soft spot for Eric, who made love like a train thundering into a tunnel? Didn't I have beaucoup evidence that Eric could defend me better than anyone I knew? I could hardly summon the energy to be shocked at myself. If you find yourself considering who to take for a lover because of his ability to defend you, you're getting pretty close to selecting a mate because you think he has desirable traits to pass along to future generations. And if there'd been a chance I could have had Eric's child, a thought that made me shiver, he would have been at the top of the list, a list I hadn't even known I'd been compiling. I pictured myself as a female peacock looking for the male peacock with the prettiest display of tail, or a wolf waiting for the leader, strongest, smartest, bravest of the pack to mount her. Okay, I'd yucked myself out. I was a human woman. I tried to be a good woman. I had to find Quinn because I had committed myself to him. Sort of. No quibbling.
What are you thinking about, Sookie?
Eric asked out of the darkness.
Your face has had thoughts rippling across it too fast to follow.
The fact that he could see me, not only in the dark, but while he was supposed to be watching the road, was exasperating and scary, and proof of his superiority, my inner cavewoman said. Eric, just get me home. I'm in emotional overload. He didn't speak again. Maybe he was being wise, or maybe the healing was painful.
We need to talk about this again,
he said when he pulled into my driveway. He parked in front of the house, turned to me as much as he could in the little car.
Sookie, I'm hurting. Can I?
He leaned over, brushed his fingers over my neck. At the very idea, my body betrayed me. A throbbing started down low, and that was just wrong. A person shouldn't get excited at the idea of being bitten. That's bad, right? I clenched my fists so tightly my fingernails made my palms hurt. Now that I could see him better, now that the interior of the car was illuminated with the harsh glare of the security light, I realized that Eric was even paler than usual. As I watched, the bullet began exiting the wound, and he leaned back against his seat, his eyes shut. Millimeter by millimeter, the bullet was extruded until it dropped into my waiting hand. I remembered Eric getting me to suck out a bullet in his arm. Ha! What a fraud he'd been. The bullet would have come out on its own. My indignation made me feel more like myself. I think you can make it home, I said, though I felt an almost irresistible urge to lean over to him and offer my neck or my wrist. I gritted my teeth and got out of the car. You can stop at Merlot's and get bottled blood if you really need some.
You're hard-hearted,
Eric said, but he didn't sound truly angry or affronted. I am, I said, and I smiled at him. You be careful, you hear?
Of course, he said, and I'm not stopping for any policemen.
I made myself march into the house without looking back. When I was inside the front door and had shut it firmly behind me, I felt an immediate relief. Thank goodness! I'd wondered if I was going to turn around at every step I took away from him. This blood tie thing was really irritating. If I wasn't careful and vigilant, I was going to do something I'd regret. I am woman. Hear me roar, I said.
Gosh, what prompted that? Amelia asked, and I jumped. She was coming down the hall from the kitchen in her nightgown and matching robe, peach with cream-colored lace trim.
Everything of Amelia's was nice. She'd never sneer at anyone else's shopping habits, but she'd never wear anything from Walmart either. I've had a trying evening, I said. I looked down at myself, only a little blood on the blue silk t-shirt. I'd have to soak it. How have things gone here? Octavia called me, Amelia said, and though she was trying to keep her voice steady, I could feel the anxiety coming off her in waves. Your mentor. I wasn't at my brightest. Yep, the one and only. She bent down to pick up Bob, who always seemed to be around if Amelia was upset. She held him to her chest and buried her face in his fur. She had heard, of course. Even after Katrina and all the changes it made in her life, she has to bring up the mistake. That was what Amelia called it. The mistake.
I wonder what Bob calls it, I said.
Amelia looked over Bob's head at me, and I knew instantly I'd said a tactless thing.
Sorry, I said. I wasn't thinking. But maybe it's not too realistic to think you can get out of this without being called to account, huh?
You're right, she said. She didn't seem too happy about my rightness, but at least she said it. I did wrong. I attempted something I shouldn't have, and Bob paid the price.
Wow, when Amelia decided to confess, she went whole hog.
I'm going to have to take my licks, she said. Maybe they'll take away my magic practice for a year, maybe longer.
Oh, that seems harsh, I said.
In my fantasy, her mentor just scolded Amelia in front of a room full of magicians and sorcerers and witches and what have you, and then they transformed Bob back. He promptly forgave Amelia and told her he loved her. Since he forgave her, the rest of the assemblage did too, and Amelia and Bob came back to my house and lived here together for a good long while. I wasn't too specific about that part.
That's the mildest punishment possible, Amelia said.
Oh.
You don't want to know the other possible sentences.
She was right. I didn't.
Well, what mysterious errand did Eric take you on? Amelia asked.
Amelia couldn't have tipped off anyone to our destination or route. She hadn't known where we were going.
He just wanted to take me to a new restaurant in Shreveport. It had a French name. It was pretty nice.
So this was like a date? I could tell she was wondering what place Quinn played in my relationship with Eric.
Oh, no, not a date, I said, sounding unconvincing even to myself. No guy-girl action going on. Just, you know, hanging out,
kissing, getting shot.
He sure is handsome, Amelia said. Yeah, no doubt about it. I've met some toothsome guys. Remember Claude?
I'd shown Amelia the poster that had arrived in the mail 2 weeks before, a blow-up of the romance novel cover for which Claude had posed. She'd been impressed. What woman wouldn't be?
I went to watch Claude strip last week.
Amelia couldn't meet my eyes.
And you didn't take me!
Claude was a very disagreeable person, especially when contrasted with his sister, Claudine, but he was beyond gorgeous. He was in the Brad Pitt stratosphere of male beauty. Of course, he was gay. Wouldn't you know it?
You went while I was at work?
I thought you wouldn't approve of my going, she said, ducking her head.
I mean, since you're friends with his sister. I went with Tara. JB was working. Are you mad?
Nah, I don't care. My friend Tara owned a dress shop, and her new husband, JB, worked at a women's exercise center.
I would like to see Claude trying to act like he was enjoying himself.
I think he was having a good time, she said. There's no one Claude loves better than Claude, right? So all these women looking at him and admiring him? He's not into women, but he's sure into being admired.
True. Let's go see him together sometime.
Okay, she said, and I could tell she was quite cheerful again. Now, tell me what you ordered at this new fancy restaurant.
So I told her. But all the while, I was wishing I didn't have to keep silent about my great-grandfather. I wanted so badly to tell Amelia about Niall, how he looked, what he'd said, that I had a whole history I hadn't known. And it would take me a while to process what my grandmother had endured, to alter my picture of her in light of the facts I'd learned. And I had to rethink my unpleasant memories of my mother, too. She'd fallen for my dad like a ton of bricks, and she'd had his kids because she loved him, only to find that she didn't want to share him with them, especially with me, another female. At least, this was my new insight.
There was more stuff, I said, a yawn splitting my jaw in two.
It was very late. But I've got to go to bed. I get any phone calls or anything?
That Ware from Shreveport called. He wanted to talk to you, and I told him you were out for the evening and he should call you on your cell. He asked if he could meet up with you, but I said I didn't know where you were.
Alcide, I said. I wonder what he wanted.
I figured I'd call him tomorrow.
And some girl called.
said she'd been a waitress at Merlot's before, and she'd seen you at the wedding last night. Tanya? Yeah, that was her name. What did she want? Don't know. She said she'd call back tomorrow or see you at the bar. Crap. I hope Sam didn't hire her to fill in or something. I thought I was the fill-in bar girl. Yeah, unless someone's quit. I warn you, Sam likes her. You don't. She's a treacherous bitch. Gosh, tell me what you really think. No kidding, Amelia. She took a job at Merlot so she could spy on me for the pelts. Oh, that's the one. Well, she won't spy on you again. I'll take steps. That was a scarier thought than working with Tanya. Amelia was a strong and skillful witch, don't get me wrong, but she was also prone to attempt things beyond her experience level, hence Bob. Check with me first, please, I said, and Amelia looked surprised. Well, sure, she said. Now I'm off to bed. She made her way up the steps with Bob in her arms, and I went to my small bathroom to remove my makeup and put on my own nightgown. Amelia hadn't noticed the speckles of blood on the shirt, and I put it in the sink to soak. What a day it had been. I'd spent time with Eric, who always rattled my chain, and I'd found a living relative, though not a human one. I'd learned a lot of stuff about my family, most of it unpleasant. I'd eaten in a fancy restaurant, though I could hardly recall the food. And finally, I'd been shot at. When I crawled into bed, I said my prayers, trying to put Quinn at the top of the list. I thought the excitement of discovering a great-grandfather would keep me awake that night. But sleep claimed me, right when I was in the middle of asking God to help me find my way through the moral morass of being party to a killing. Chapter 6. There was a knock on the front door the next morning about an hour before I wanted to wake up. I heard it only because Bob had come into my room and jumped on my bed, settling in the space behind my knees while I lay on my side. He purred loudly, and I reached down to scratch behind his ears. I loved cats. That didn't stop me from liking dogs, too, and only the fact that I was gone so much kept me from getting a puppy. Terry Belfleur had offered me one, but I'd wavered until his pups were gone. I wondered if Bob would mind a kitten companion. Would Amelia get jealous if I bought a female cat? I had to smile even as I snuggled deeper into the bed. But I wasn't truly asleep, and I did hear the knock. I muttered a few words about the person at the door, and I slid on my slippers and threw on my thin blue cotton bathrobe. The morning had a hint of chill, reminding me that despite the mild and sunny days, this was October. There were Halloweens when even a sweater was too warm, and there were Halloweens when you had to wear a light coat when you did your trick-or-treating. I looked through the peephole and saw an elderly black woman with a halo of white hair. She was light-skinned, and her features were narrow and sharp, nose, lips, eyes. She was wearing magenta lipstick and a yellow pantsuit. But she didn't seem armed or dangerous. This just goes to show how misleading first appearances can be. I opened the door.
Young lady, I'm here to see Amelia Broadway,
the woman informed me in very precisely pronounced English. Please come in, I said, because this was an older woman and I'd been brought up to revere old people. Have a seat, I indicated the couch. I'll go up and get Amelia. I noticed she didn't apologize for getting me out of bed or for showing up unannounced. I climbed the stairs with a grim feeling that Amelia wasn't going to enjoy this message. I so seldom went up to the second floor that it surprised me to see how nice Amelia had made it look. Since the upper bedrooms had only basic furniture in them, she turned the one to the right, the larger one, into her bedroom. The one to the left was her sitting room. It held her television, an easy chair and ottoman, a small computer desk and her computer, and a plant or two. The bedroom, which I believed had been built for a generation of stack houses that had sired three boys in quick succession, had only a small closet, But Amelia had bought rolling clothes racks from somewhere on the internet and assembled them handily. Then she'd bought a tri-fold screen at an auction and repainted it and arranged it in front of the racks to camouflage them. Her bright bedspread and the old table she'd repainted to serve as her makeup table added to the color that jumped out from the white-painted walls. Amid all this cheer was one dismal witch. Amelia was sitting up in bed, her short hair mashed into strange shapes.
"Who is that I hear downstairs?"
she asked in a very hushed voice. "Older black lady, light-skinned, sharp way about her?"
"Oh, my God,"
Amelia breathed and slumped back against her dozen or so pillows.
"It's Octavia."
"Well, you come down and have a word with her. I can't entertain her." Amelia snarled at me, but she accepted the inevitable. She got out of bed and pulled off her nightgown. She pulled on a bra and panties and some jeans, and she extracted a sweater from a drawer. I went down to tell Octavia Fant that Amelia was coming. Amelia would have to walk right past her to get to the bathroom, since there was only the one staircase, but at least I could smooth the way. "Can I get you some coffee?" I asked. The older woman was busy looking around the room with her bright brown eyes.
"If you have some tea, I'd like a cup,"
Octavia Fant said. "Yes, ma'am, we have some," I said, relieved that Amelia had insisted on buying it. I had no idea what kind it was, and I hoped it was in a bag, because I'd never made hot tea in my life.
"Good,"
she said, and that was that. "Amelia's on her way down," I said, trying to think of some graceful way to add, "and she's going to have to hurry through the room to pee and brush her teeth, so pretend you don't see her." I abandoned that lost cause and fled to the kitchen. I retrieved Amelia's tea from one of her designated shelves, and while the water was getting hot, I got down two cups and saucers and put them on a tray. I added the sugar bowl and tiny pitcher with milk and two spoons.
"Napkins,"
I thought, and wished I had some cloth ones instead of regular paper. This was how Octavia Fant made me feel, without her using a bit of magic on me. I heard the water running in the hall bathroom just as I put a handful of cookies on a plate and added that to the assemblage. I didn't have any flowers or a little vase, which was the only other thing I thought of that I could have added. I picked up the tray and made my way slowly down the hall to the living room. I set the tray down on the coffee table in front of Ms. Fant. She looked up at me with her piercing eyes and gave me a curt nod of thanks. I realized that I could not read her mind. I'd been holding off, waiting for a moment when I could really give her her proper due, but she knew how to block me out. I'd never met a human who could do that. For a second, I felt almost irritated. Then I remembered who and what she was, and I scooted off to my room to make my bed and visit my own little bathroom. I passed Amelia in the hall, and she gave me a scared look. "Sorry, Amelia," I thought, as I closed my bedroom door firmly. "You're on your own." I didn't have to be at work until the evening, so I put on some old jeans and a Fantasia t-shirt, the bar with a bite. Pam had given it to me when the bar first started selling them. I slid my feet into some Crocs and went into the kitchen to fix my own beverage, coffee. I made some toast and got the local paper I'd grabbed when I'd answered the door. Rolling the rubber band off, I glanced at the front page. The school board had met, the local Walmart had donated generously to the Boys and Girls Club's after-school program, and the state legislature had voted to recognize vampire-human marriages. Well, well, no one had thought that bill would ever pass. I flipped open the paper to read the obituaries. First the local deaths, no one I knew, good. Then the area deaths. Oh, no. "Maria Starr Cooper," read the heading. The item said only, "Maria Starr Cooper, 25, a resident of Shreveport, died unexpectedly at her home yesterday. Cooper, a photographer, is survived by her mother and father, Matthew and Stella Cooper, of Minden, and three brothers. Arrangements are pending." I felt suddenly out of breath and sank into the straight-backed chair with a feeling of total disbelief. Maria Starr and I hadn't exactly been friends, but I'd liked her well enough, and she and Alcide Hervaux, a major figure in the Shreveport Ware Pack, had been going together for months. Poor Alcide. His first girlfriend had died violently, and now this. The phone rang, and I jumped. I grabbed it up with a terrible feeling of disaster. Hello? I said cautiously, as if the phone could spit at me.
Sookie,
said Alcide. He had a deep voice, and now it was husky with tears. I'm so sorry, I said. I just read the paper. There was nothing else to say. Now I knew why he'd called the night before.
She was murdered,
Alcide said.
Oh, my God.
Sookie, it was only the beginning. On the off chance that Fernan is after you, too, I want you to stay alert.
Too late, I said, after a moment given to absorbing this awful news. Someone tried to kill me last night. Alcide held the phone away from him and howled. Hearing this, in the middle of the day, over the telephone, even then it was frightening. Trouble within the Shreveport Pack had been brewing for a while. Even I, separated from Ware politics, had known that. Patrick Fernan, the leader of the Longtooth Pack, had gotten his office by killing Alcide's father in combat. The victory had been legal, well, Ware legal, but there had been a few not-so-legal plays along the way. Alcide, strong, young, prosperous, and packing a grudge, had always been a threat to Fernan, at least in Fernan's mind. This was a tense topic, since Wares were secret from the human population, not out in the open like vampires. The day was coming, and coming soon, when the shifter population would step forward. I'd heard them speak of it over and over. But that hadn't happened yet, and it wouldn't be good if the first knowledge the humans had of the Wares was of bodies turning up all over the place.
Someone will be over there right away,
Alcide said. Absolutely not. I have to go to work tonight, and I'm so utterly on the edge of this thing that I'm sure they won't try again. But I do need to know how the guy knew where and when to find me.
Tell Amanda the circumstances,
Alcide said, his voice thick with anger. And then Amanda came on. Hard to believe that when I'd seen her at the wedding, we'd both been so cheerful. Tell me, she said crisply, and I knew this was no time to argue. I told her the story as tersely as possible, leaving out Niall and Eric's name and most other details. And she was silent for a few seconds after I'd finished speaking.
Since he was taken out, that's one less we have to worry about, she said, sounding simply relieved. I wish you'd known who he was.
Sorry, I said a bit acidly. I was thinking about the gun, not his ID.
How come you all can have a war with as few people as you have?
The Shreveport Pack couldn't number over 30.
Reinforcements from other territories.
Why would anyone do that?
Why join in a war that wasn't yours? What was the point of losing your own people when it was the other pack's dispute?
There are perks to backing the winning side, Amanda said. Listen, you still got that witch living with you?
I do.
Then there's something you can do to help.
Okay, I said, though I didn't recall offering. What would that be?
You need to ask your witch friend if she'll go to Maria Starr's apartment and get some kind of reading on what happened there. Is that possible? We want to know the wares involved.
It's possible, but I don't know if she'll do it.
Ask her now, please.
Let me call you back. She's got a visitor.
Before I went out to the living room, I made a call. I didn't want to leave this message on the answering machine at Fantasia, which wouldn't be open yet, so I called Pam's cell, something I'd never done before. As it rang, I found myself wondering if it was in the coffin with her. That was an eerie thing to picture. I didn't know if Pam actually slept in a coffin or not, but if she did, I shuddered. Of course, the phone went to voicemail, and I said,
Pam, I found out why Eric and I were pulled over last night, or at least I think so. There's a Ware war brewing, and I think I was the target. Someone sold us out to Patrick Fernan, and I didn't tell anyone where I was going.
That was a problem Eric and I had been too shaken to discuss the night before. How had anyone at all, known where we'd be last night? That we'd be driving back from Shreveport? Amelia and Octavia were in the middle of a discussion, but neither of them looked as angry or upset as I'd feared. I hate to intrude, I said, as both pairs of eyes turned to me. Octavia's were brown, Amelia's bright blue, but at the moment they were eerily alike in expression.
Yes?
Octavia was clearly queen of the situation. Any witch worth her salt would know about wares. I condensed the issues of the Ware War down to a few sentences, told them about the attack the night before on the interstate, and explained Amanda's request.
Is this something you should get involved with, Amelia?
Octavia asked, her voice making it quite clear there was only one answer she should give.
Oh, I think so, Amelia said. She smiled. Can't have someone shooting at my roomie. I'll help Amanda.
Octavia couldn't have been more shocked if Amelia had spat a watermelon seed on her pants.
Amelia, you're trying things beyond your ability. This will lead to terrible trouble. Look what you've already done to poor Bob Jessup.
Oh, boy, I hadn't known Amelia that long, but I already knew that was a poor way to get her to comply with your wishes. If Amelia was proud of anything, it was her witchy ability. Challenging her expertise was a sure way to rattle her. On the other hand, Bob was a major fuck-up.
Can you change him back? I asked the older witch.
Octavia looked at me sharply.
Of course,
she said.
Then why don't you do it, and we can go from there,
I said. Octavia looked very startled, and I knew I shouldn't have gotten up in her face like that. On the other hand, if she wanted to show Amelia that her magic was more powerful, here was her chance. Bob the cat was sitting in Amelia's lap, looking unconcerned. Octavia reached in her pocket and pulled out a pill container filled with what looked like marijuana. But I guess any dried herb pretty much looks the same, and I haven't ever actually handled marijuana, so I'm no judge. Anyway, Octavia took a pinch of this dried green stuff and reached out to let the bits drop on the cat's fur. Bob didn't seem to mind. Amelia's face was a picture as she watched Octavia casting a spell, which seemed to consist of some Latin, a few motions, and the aforementioned herb. Finally, Octavia uttered what must have been the esoteric equivalent of Alakazam and pointed at the cat. Nothing happened. Octavia repeated the phrase even more forcefully, again with the finger pointing, and again with the no results.
You know what I think?
I said. No one seemed to want to know, but it was my house. I wonder if maybe Bob was always a cat, and for some reason he was temporarily human. That's why you can't change him back. Maybe he's in his true form right now.
That's ridiculous.
The older witch snapped. She was some kind of put out at her failure. Amelia was trying hard to suppress a grin.
If you're so sure after this that Amelia's incompetent, which I happen to know she isn't, you might want to consider coming to see Maria Starr's apartment with us, I said. Make sure Amelia doesn't get into any trouble.
Amelia looked indignant for a second, but she seemed to see my plan, and she added her entreaty to mine.
Very well, I'll come along, Octavia said grandly.
I couldn't see into the old witch's mind, but I'd worked at a bar long enough to know a lonely person when I saw one. I got the address from Amanda, who told me Dawson was guarding the place until we arrived. I knew him and liked him, since he'd helped me out before. He owned a local motorcycle repair shop a couple of miles out of Bonton, and he sometimes ran Merlot's for Sam. Dawson didn't run with a pack, and the news that he was pitching in with Alcide's rebel faction was significant. I can't say the drive to the outskirts of Shreveport was a bonding experience for the three of us, but I did fill Octavia in on the background of the pack troubles, and I explained my own involvement.
When the contest for Packmaster was taking place, I said, Alcide wanted me there as a human lie detector.
I actually did catch the other guy cheating, which was good, but after that it became a fight to the death, and Patrick Fernan was stronger. He killed Jackson Hervaux.
I guess they covered up the death?
The old witch seemed neither shocked nor surprised.
Yes, they put the body out at an isolated farm he owned, knowing no one would look there for a while. The wounds on the body weren't recognizable by the time he was found.
Has Patrick Fernan been a good leader?
I really don't know, I admitted. Alcide has always seemed to have a discontented group around him, and they're the ones I know best in the pack. So I guess I'm on Alcide's side.
Did you ever consider that you could just step aside, let the best wear win?
No, I said honestly. I would have been just as glad if Alcide hadn't called me and told me about the pack troubles. But now that I know, I'll help him if I can. Not that I'm an angel or anything, but Patrick Fernan hates me, and it's only smart to help his enemy, point number one. And I liked Maria Starr, point number two. And someone tried to kill me last night, someone who may have been hired by Fernan, point number three. Octavia nodded. She was sure no wussy old lady. Maria Starr had lived in a rather dated apartment building on Highway 3 between Benton and Shreveport. It was a small complex, just two buildings side by side facing a parking lot right there on the highway. The buildings backed onto a field, and the adjacent businesses were day businesses, an insurance agency and a dentist's office. Each of the two red brick buildings was divided into four apartments. I noticed a familiar battered pickup truck in front of the building on the right, and I parked by it. These apartments were enclosed. You went in the common entrance into a hall, and there was a door on either side of the stairway to the second floor. Maria Starr had lived on the ground floor left apartment. This was easy to spot, because Dawson was propped against the wall beside her door. I introduced him to the two witches as Dawson because I didn't know his first name. Dawson was a supersized man. I'd bet you could crack pecans on his biceps. He had dark brown hair, beginning to show just a little gray, and a neatly trimmed mustache. I'd known who he was all my life, but I'd never known him well. Dawson was probably 7 or 8 years older than me, and he'd married early, and divorced early, too. His son, who lived with the mother, was quite a football player for Clarice High School. Dawson looked tougher than any guy I'd ever met. I don't know if it was the very dark eyes, or the grim face, or simply the size of him. There was crime scene tape across the apartment doorway. My eyes welled up when I saw it. Maria Starr had died violently in this space only hours before. Dawson produced a set of keys, Alcide's, and unlocked the door, and we ducked under the tape to enter. And we all stood frozen in silence, appalled at the state of the little living room. My way was blocked by an overturned occasional table with a big gash marring the wood. My eyes flickered over the irregular dark stains on the walls until my brain told me the stains were blood. The smell was faint but unpleasant. I began to breathe shallowly so I wouldn't get sick.
Now, what do you want us to do? Octavia asked.
I thought you'd do an ectoplasmic reconstruction like Amelia did before, I said.
Amelia did an ectoplasmic reconstruction?
Octavia had dropped the haughty tone and sounded genuinely surprised and admiring.
I've never seen one.
Amelia nodded modestly.
With Terry and Bob and Patsy, she said. It worked great. We had a big area to cover.
Then I'm sure we can do one here,
Octavia said. She looked interested and excited. It was like her face had woken up. I realized that what I'd seen before had been her depressed face, and I was getting enough from her head, now that she wasn't concentrating on keeping me out, to let me know that Octavia had spent a month after Katrina wondering where her next meal would come from, where she'd lay her head from night to night. Now she lived with family, though I didn't get a clean picture.
I brought the stuff with me, Amelia said.
Her brain was radiating pride and relief. She might yet get out from under the Bob contretemps without paying a huge price. Dawson stood leaning against the wall, listening with apparent interest. Since he was aware, it was hard to read his thoughts, but he was definitely relaxed. I envied him. It wasn't possible for me to be at ease in this terrible little apartment, which almost echoed with the violence done in its walls. I was scared to sit on the love seat or the armchair, both upholstered in blue and white checks. The carpet was a darker blue, and the paint was white. Everything matched. The apartment was a little dull for my taste, but it had been neat and clean and carefully arranged, and less than 24 hours ago, it had been a home. I could see through to the bedroom, where the covers were thrown back. This was the only sign of disorder in the bedroom or the kitchen. The living room had been the center of the violence. For lack of a better place to park myself, I went to lean against the bare wall beside Dawson. I didn't think the motorcycle repairman and I had ever had a long conversation, though he'd gotten shot in my defense a few months before. I'd heard that the law, in this case Andy Belfleur and his fellow detective Al C. Beck, suspected more took place at Dawson's shop than motorcycle repairs, but they'd never caught Dawson doing anything illegal. Dawson also hired out as a bodyguard from time to time, or maybe he volunteered his services. He was certainly suited to the job.
"Were you friends?"
Dawson rumbled, nodding his head at the bloodiest spot on the floor, the spot where Maria Starr had died. "We were more like friendly acquaintances," I said, not wanting to claim more grief than my due. "I saw her at a wedding a couple of nights ago." I started to say she'd been fine then, but that would have been stupid. You don't sicken before you're murdered. "When was the last time anyone talked to Maria Starr?" Amelia asked Dawson. "I need to establish some time limits."
11 last night, he said. "Phone call from Alcide. He was out of town with witnesses. Neighbor heard a big to-do from in here about 30 minutes after that. Called the police."
That was a long speech for Dawson. Amelia went back to her preparations, and Octavia read a thin book that Amelia had extracted from her little backpack.
"Have you ever watched one of these before?"
Dawson said to me.
"Yeah, in New Orleans. I gather this is kind of rare and hard to do. Amelia's really good."
"She's living with you?"
I nodded.
"That's what I heard,"
he said.
We were quiet for a moment. Dawson was proving to be a restful companion as well as a handy hunk of muscle.
There was some gesturing and there was some chanting, with Octavia following her one-time student. Octavia might never have done an ectoplasmic reconstruction, but the longer the ritual went on, the more power reverberated in the small room, until my fingernails seemed to hum with it. Dawson didn't exactly look frightened, but he was definitely on the alert as the pressure of the magic built. He uncrossed his arms and stood up straight, and I did too. Though I knew what to expect, it was still startling to me when Maria Starr appeared in the room with us. Beside me, I felt Dawson jerk with surprise. Maria Starr was painting her toenails. Her long, dark hair was gathered into a ponytail on top of her head. She was sitting on the carpet in front of the television, a sheet of newspaper spread carefully under her foot. The magically recreated image had the same watery look I'd seen in a previous reconstruction when I'd observed my cousin Hadley during her last few hours on Earth. Maria Starr wasn't exactly in color. She was like an image filled with glistening gel. Because the apartment was no longer in the same order it had been in when she'd sat in that spot, the effect was odd. She was sitting right in the middle of the overturned coffee table. We didn't have long to wait. Maria Starr finished her toenails and sat watching the television set, now dark and dead, while she waited for them to dry. She did a few leg exercises while she waited. Then she gathered up the polish and the little spacers she'd had between her toes and folded the paper. She rose and went into the bathroom. Since the actual bathroom door was now half closed, the watery Maria Starr had to walk through it. From our angle, Dawson and I couldn't see inside, but Amelia, whose hands were extended in a kind of sustaining gesture, gave a little shrug, as if to say Maria Starr was not doing anything important. Ectoplasmic peeing, maybe. In a few minutes, the young woman appeared again, this time in her nightgown. She went into the bedroom and turned back the bed. Suddenly, her head turned toward the door. It was like watching a pantomime. Clearly, Maria Starr had heard a sound at her door, and the sound was unexpected. I didn't know if she was hearing the doorbell, a knocking, or someone trying to pick the lock. Her alert posture turned to alarm, even panic. She went back into the living room and picked up her cell phone. We saw it appear when she touched it, and punched a couple of numbers, calling someone on speed dial. But before the phone could even have rung on the other end, the door exploded inward, and a man was on her, a half-wolf, half-man. He showed up because he was a living thing, but he was clearer when he was close to Maria Starr, the focus of the spell. He pinned Maria Starr to the floor and bit her deeply on her shoulder. Her mouth opened wide, and you could tell she was screaming and she was fighting like a ware, but he'd caught her totally by surprise, and her arms were pinned down. Gleaming lines indicated blood running down from the bite. Dawson gripped my shoulder, a growl rising from his throat. I didn't know if he was furious at the attack on Maria Starr, excited by the action of the impression of flowing blood, or all of the above. A second ware was right behind the first. He was in his human form. He had a knife in his right hand. He plunged it into Maria Starr's torso, withdrew it, reared back, and plunged it in again. As the knife rose and fell, it cast blood drops on the walls. We could see the blood drops, so there must be ectoplasm, or whatever it really is, in blood, too. I hadn't known the first man. This guy, I recognized. He was Cal Myers, a henchman of Fernand's, and a police detective on the Shreveport force. The Blitz attack had taken only seconds. The moment Maria Starr was clearly mortally wounded, they were at the door, closing it behind them. I was shocked by the sudden and dreadful cruelty of the murder, and I felt my breath coming faster. Maria Starr, glistening and almost clear, lay there before us for a moment in the middle of the wreckage, gleaming blood splotches on her shirt and on the floor around her, and then she just winked out of existence because she had died in that moment. We all stood in appalled silence. The witches were silent, their arms dropping down by their sides as if they were puppets whose strings had been cut. Octavia was crying, tears running down her creased cheeks. Amelia looked as though she were thinking of throwing up. I was shivering in reaction, and even Dawson looked nauseated.
"I didn't know the first guy since he'd only half changed,"
Dawson said.
"The second one looked familiar. He's a cop, right? In Shreveport?"
"Cal Myers. Better call Alcide," I said when I thought my voice would work. "And Alcide needs to send these ladies something for their trouble when he gets his own sorted out." I figured Alcide might not think of that since he was mourning for Maria Starr, but the witches had done this work with no mention of recompense. They deserved to be rewarded for their effort. It had cost them dearly. Both of them had folded onto the love seat.
"If you ladies can manage," Dawson said, "we better get our asses out of here. No telling when the police will be back. The crime lab finished just 5 minutes before you got here."
While the witches gathered their energy and all their paraphernalia, I talked to Dawson. "You said Alcide's got a good alibi?" Dawson nodded.
"He got a phone call from Maria Starr's neighbor. She called Alcide right after she called the police, when she heard all the ruckus. Granted, the call was to his cell phone, but he answered right away, and she could hear the sounds of the hotel bar behind the conversation. Plus, he was in the bar with people he just met, who swore he was there when he found out she'd been killed. They aren't likely to forget."
"I guess the police are trying to find a motive. That was what they did on the TV shows."
"She didn't have enemies,"
Dawson said. "Now what?" Amelia said. She and Octavia were on their feet, but they were clearly drained. Dawson shepherded us out of the apartment and relocked it.
Thanks for coming, ladies,
Dawson told Amelia and Octavia. He turned to me.
Sookie, could you come with me? Explain to Alcide what we just saw. Can Amelia drive Miss Fant back?
Sure, if she's not too tired. Amelia said she thought she could manage. We'd come in my car, so I tossed her the keys. You okay driving? I asked, just to reassure myself. She nodded. I'll take it slow. I was scrambling into Dawson's truck when I realized that this step dragged me even further into the Ware War. Then I figured, Patrick Fernan already tried to kill me. Can't get any worse. Chapter 7 Dawson's pickup, a Dodge Ram, although battered on the outside, was orderly within. It wasn't a new vehicle by any means, probably 5 years old, but it was very well maintained both under the hood and in the cab. You're not a member of the pack, Dawson, right?
It's Trey. Trey Dawson.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dawson shrugged, as if to say no big deal.
I never was a good pack animal, he said. I couldn't keep in line. I couldn't follow the chain of command.
So why are you joining in this fight? I said.
Patrick Fernan tried to put me out of business,
Dawson said. Why'd he do that?
Aren't that many other motorcycle repair shops in the area, especially since Fernan bought the Harley-Davidson dealership in Shreveport,
Trey explained.
That so-and-so's greedy. He wants it all for himself. He doesn't care who goes broke. When he realized I was sticking with my shop, he sent a couple of his guys down to see me. They beat me up, busted up the shop.
They must have been really good, I said. It was hard to believe anyone could best Trey Dawson. Did you call the police?
No. The cops in Bonneton aren't that crazy about me anyway, but I threw in with Alcide.
Detective Cal Myers, obviously, was not above doing Fernan's dirty work. It was Myers who'd collaborated with Fernan in cheating in the Packmaster contest. But I was truly shocked that he would go as far as murdering Maria Starr, whose only sin was being loved by Alcide. We'd seen it with our own eyes, though. What's the deal with you and the police in Bonneton? I asked, as long as we were talking about law enforcement. He laughed.
I used to be a cop. Did you know that?
No, I said, genuinely surprised. No kidding.
For real, he said. I was on the force in New Orleans, but I didn't like the politics, and my captain was a real bastard. Pardon me.
I nodded gravely. It had been a long time since someone had apologized for using bad language within my hearing. So, something happened?
Yeah. Eventually, things came to a head. The captain accused me of taking some money this scuzzbag had left lying on a table when we arrested him in his home.
Trey shook his head in disgust.
I had to quit then. I liked the job.
What did you like about it?
No 2 days were alike. Yeah, sure, we got in the cars and patrolled. That was the same. But every time we got out, something different would happen.
I nodded. I could understand that. Every day at the bar was a little different, too, though probably not as different as Trey's days had been in the patrol car. We drove in silence for a while. I could tell Trey was thinking about the odds of Alcide overcoming Fernan in the struggle for dominance. He was thinking Alcide was a lucky guy to have dated Maria Starr and me, and all the luckier since that bitch Debbie Pelt had vanished. Good riddance, Trey thought.
Now I get to ask you a question,
Trey said. Only fair.
You have something to do with Debbie disappearing?
I took a deep breath. Yeah. Self-defense.
Good for you. Someone needed to do it.
We were quiet again for at least 10 minutes. Not to drag the past into the present too much, but Alcide had broken up with Debbie Pelt before I met him. Then he dated me a little. Debbie decided I was an enemy, and she tried to kill me. I got her first. I'd come to terms with it, as much as you ever do. However, it had been impossible for Alcide to ever look at me again in the same way, and who could blame him?
He'd found Maria Starr, and that was a good thing. Had been a good thing. I felt tears well up in my eyes and looked out the window. We'd passed the racetrack and the turnoff to Pierre Bossier Mall, and we went a couple more exits before Trey turned the truck onto the off-ramp. We meandered through a modest neighborhood for a while, Trey checking his rearview mirror so often that even I realized he was watching for anyone following us. Trey suddenly turned into a driveway and pulled around to the back of one of the slightly larger homes, which was demurely clad in white siding.